From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Mary Cheney. She's written a new memoir about working on her father's vice presidential campaigns. She writes that she nearly left the 2004 campaign after President Bush spoke out in support of a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage. We'll talk about how she reconciled remaining on the campaign, although she is a lesbian in a long-term relationship. Also, Mary Carr, author of the best-selling memoirs The Liars Club and Cherry, reads from her new collection of poems, Sinner's Welcome. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Mary Chaney, has written a new memoir called Now It's My Turn about her experiences working on her father's vice presidential campaigns in 2000 and 2004. In the Bush-Cheney re-election campaign, she was director of vice presidential operations. One of the questions she addresses in her book is, as a lesbian in a long-term relationship, how did she reconcile working on the 2004 campaign when President Bush advocated a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage? Cheney is now chief of staff for Ted Leonsis, the vice chairman of AOL. Before working on her father's campaigns, she'd worked for Coors Brewery as a marketing liaison, doing outreach to the gay community, which had tried to boycott the company. Why did you decide to write this book?
You know, one thing that happens to you when you're in the public eye, frequently the media develop this caricature of you. In my dad's case, he's the Darth Vader behind the Bush presidency. This idea is a sort of malevolent force. And as his daughter of 37 years, I can honestly vouch for the fact that it's not true. And I really wanted to present an accurate portrayal of my dad to let the rest of the world know the man that I love so much.
Does it surprise you that some people think of him as being the Darth Vader type?
Probably not as much as you'd think it would. One of the things that I do love about my dad is and admire about him is he is someone who, he wakes up every morning worried about, what am I going to do today to keep this country safe? What am I going to do to help the president move his agenda forward? He's really focused on doing what's right, doing what he knows is in the best interest of the country. And unlike a lot of politicians, especially in Washington, he doesn't spend very much time worrying about his publicity polls or his popularity. And so he's not somebody who's going to waste much time fighting back against this, Darth Vader image.
You say in your book that you considered leaving your father's campaign after the president supported an amendment to ban gay marriage in his January 2004 State of the Union address. Was it a surprise that the president supported an amendment to ban gay marriage?
It wasn't in that I knew it was coming. I think when you read the book, I talk about really having the internal debate with myself and talking to my family about it before the president actually endorsed it. He'd come darn close to it in the State of the Union when he talked about defending marriage. And what was a surprise for me was that, I think it was a surprise for most people, was that gay marriage really did become an issue in 2004. When I first signed on the campaign in June of 2003, it was before the Lawrence decision in the Supreme Court. It was before the Massachusetts State Supreme Court handed down their decision. It was not an issue that was front and center on a lot of people's radar screens.
So why did you decide to stay with the campaign?
First and foremost, my dad. I believe so strongly in my dad as a person, as a father, as a leader, I wanted to stay and support him. And I'd made a commitment to support him. Obviously, I hadn't known, back in early 2003 that President Bush was going to endorse the federal marriage amendment, or there would be a federal marriage amendment. But, that didn't change the fact that I'd made a commitment. And the other reason is, quite frankly, we live in a world where there are terrorists, where there are people and countries who support them, who will do whatever they can to hurt this country and to hurt this nation. And, given that we live in that world, it is of dire importance that we have leaders, that we have a president, a commander-in-chief, who is forceful, who does understand the importance of protecting the country, who's going to do the best job of keeping this country safe. And, quite frankly, in 2004, there was no question that it was George Bush. And, I personally didn't feel like I had the luxury of being a single-issue voter on the issue of same-sex marriage, given the world that we live in.
Why do you oppose an amendment to ban gay marriage?
Because, quite frankly, I could give you the thumbnail sketch, which is it's wrong to write discrimination of the Constitution. But because, I think if you look at our Constitution, it's been amended, I believe, 17 times since the Bill of Rights. And if you look at those amendments, by and large, they are about expanding freedom. They are about increasing inclusion and empowerment, involving more people in our society, whether it's the abolition of slavery or suffrage for women or the direct election of senators or lowering the voting age. That is the story of our Constitution and, quite frankly, the story of our country. Something like the Federal Marriage Amendment, flies in the face of that. It is explicitly exclusionary. It is saying that this group of people are not entitled to the same rights as everyone else.
Now, I know that your mother, Lynn Cheney, has said that she doesn't support a federal amendment to ban gay marriage because she thinks it's a state's issue. And your father had said that he thought it was a state's issue during one of the debates. But did he change his mind subsequent to that and support a constitutional amendment?
No, he's actually always been very clear. And there's a chapter in my book titled Freedom Means Freedom for Everyone that's about the Federal Marriage Amendment. And the line comes from my dad's debate with Joe Lieberman when Bernie Shaw, the debate moderator, asked him about the issue of recognizing relationships. And my dad's always been very clear that he does not support the Federal Marriage Amendment.
But, both of your parents have said that they think it's a state issue, not a federal issue. And there are already some states that have passed laws banning gay marriage and other states that are considering it. And now that it looks like there won't be a federal amendment in the immediate future to ban gay marriage, more states might consider banning it on a state level. I'd really love to hear if you know what your parents think of banning it on a state level, because they've said it's a state issue, not a federal issue, but they've never actually taken a stand, to my knowledge, about where they stand on gay marriage.
Well, it is a state issue in that it's one of the responsibilities that has always been given to states to decide. States set their own laws regarding marriage. What I can tell you is that I can only speak for myself. I'm not really here to represent somebody else's views, and that my parents publicly have both stated their opposition to the Federal Marriage Amendment.
But they've never said what they think of gay marriage. Are you not willing to say on their behalf? Because they don't seem...
I'm not comfortable. I've made a point in life of only representing my own point of view.
What is your point of view on that?
My own point of view is I think this is an issue that is very important for our country to debate. Personally, I would prefer it be an issue that is handled through the legislative branch, not by the courts. But regardless of how it's handled, I ultimately believe we will see same-sex marriage, whether it's called marriage or called civil unions. I believe that is not that far off.
But you haven't said whether you support it or not yet.
I do. I'm sorry. I completely support it. How's that?
Okay. That's good. Thank you for making that clear.
All right.
My guest is Mary Cheney, and she's written a new memoir called Now It's My Turn, A Daughter's Chronicle of Political Life, and it's about her work in her father's vice presidential campaigns in 2000 and 2004. The Bush-Cheney administration was twice elected with support of the religious right, and their campaign emphasized values. And for many leaders on the religious right, at the top of the list of values was banning gay marriage and talking about homosexuality as something that was very threatening to society. Were you comfortable knowing that even though your father may have disagreed with that emphasis, that he was still in alliance with a group of leaders who fervently believe that your way of life threatens America?
One thing that I like about the Republican Party is we are a varied bunch of people. There are people who I passionately disagree with regarding the issue of same-sex marriage, regarding the issue of gay rights. But I also question the assessment that this was an election, especially in 2004, that this was an election about gay rights. Matthew Dowd, who was the strategist on the Bush-Cheney campaign, gave an interview in the last few weeks, in which he talked about the fact that that's sort of one of the urban legends of the 2004 campaign, that you know, the federal marriage amendment and the president's support of it really, you know, drove home support with evangelical voters and with opponents of same-sex marriage. And that, but if you really go look at voter turnout records in states that had gay marriage initiatives on the ballots and states that didn't, it was actually identical. When push came to shove, this really wasn't an election that was driven by this issue. That what it really came down to was it was a national election, by and large, about national security issues.
But I think it's fair to say that the Bush-Cheney ticket tried to portray the election as being about values, and certainly their supporters on the religious right did, and the Republican platform had planks opposing gay marriage and gay adoption. So I guess what I'm wondering is if that alliance between your father and President Bush and the religious right, knowing that the religious right's number one issue at the time was opposing gay marriage, if that made you uncomfortable, because in the world of politics, what it means is that that relation empowers the group that, you know, the religious right, which opposed gay marriage, the alliance empowered them. And it also made the Bush administration, you'd argue, more beholden to the people who helped put them in office, the religious right. So, you know, it kind of empowered that idea of homosexual marriage as a threat to our society, as a threat to families.
I would strongly object to the notion that the Bush Cheney administration is beholden to any particular group. They have been, you know, the president in particular, I mean, whom I disagree with on this issue, have always been governing from the point of view of what is best for this country. I would hate to think of a leader who is going to say, I'm going to govern based upon what is best or what is in the interest of the religious right or the far left. Anyone who is going to try and govern based upon a splinter of our society. You're president of everyone. You're not president of, you know, 5% of the population.
Well, you said you wanted to stand up for what you believed in. One of the things you believe in is that, you know, homosexuality is an okay part of normal life, and that homosexuals should be able to have relationships under law like everybody else. But it's not something that's not a belief you stood up for during the campaign. Did you feel like it would have been inappropriate or bad for your father's campaign to do that? Why were you silent about that issue, which you believe in?
You know, one of the things that I really respect about George Bush, and one of the things that really reemphasized to me why I stayed on the campaign and why he was the right person to be leading us, is that he let me know that the day that he endorsed the federal marriage amendment, the day he went out in front of the press corps and did that, he let it be known to me that he would understand if I wanted to put out my own statement talking about how much I disagreed with him. And I thought about it. I really did. But ultimately, I decided against it.
Why?
Because, quite frankly, I was a staffer on the campaign. I was director of vice presidential operations. And I think, from my own perspective, it is inappropriate for staffers to be issuing their own public policy statements. I was, of course, you know, I would have been free to quit the campaign and make whatever statement I wanted to make. But because I, you know, believed in these candidates, because I believed in this ticket, you know, I wanted to work on that campaign. And I didn't want to set the precedent of, you know, staffers expressing and representing their own opinion rather than the opinion of the candidate that they were working for.
My guest is Mary Cheney. Her new memoir is called Now It's My Turn. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mary Cheney, and she has a new memoir called Now It's My Turn. There were times when you were noticeably absent, like after your father spoke at the Republican convention in 2004, and the whole family, including your sister and her husband and their children, were on stage, but you and your partner were absent. Was that, did that have anything to do with, why were you absent?
That actually has more to do with the fact that Heather, my partner, is an incredibly private person. And so she and I talked about it before we went to the convention in New York. My folks had told us whatever we wanted to do was fine with them. They'd love us to be on stage, but they also understood if we didn't want to go up there. And pretty much just because Heather was so uncomfortable with it. I mean, honestly, I love her, but if you look at the footage of her, of us on stage at the victory party, she's uncomfortable. She did it because, she loves me and wanted to support me, and I really wanted to go out there, but she really didn't want to go on stage, and I certainly didn't want to push her. So we watched, and then we went and celebrated with my parents downstairs.
A lot of people assume that you weren't there because on a ticket that had the support of so many people who were anti-gay, it might have seemed a little odd to have the gay daughter and her partner on stage.
Well, the way Heather and I looked at it is, especially because that was just a few days after Alan Keyes had called me a selfish hedonist, Heather and I looked at it as, look, whatever we do, it's going to make news, and people are going to talk about it and speculate about it. So, let's just do what we want to do, and that's not go on stage.
I'm interested in hearing your reaction, at the Senate debate on the amendment to ban gay marriage. The most quoted, now infamous remark, is from Senator James Imhoff of Oklahoma, who stood in front of a large portrait of his extended family and said, as you see here, and I think this is maybe the most important prop we'll have during the entire debate, my wife and I have been married 47 years. We have 20 kids and grandkids, and I'm really proud to say that in the recorded history of our family, we've never had a divorce or any kind of homosexual relationship. What was your reaction when you heard that?
I'm really glad Senator Inhofe's not my dad.
Do you think that he's saying in a way that your family and every family that has a homosexual in it should be embarrassed?
I try not to read too much into people's comments. From my own perspective, it was not an embarrassing comment to me. If Senator Inhofe has an issue with my family, that, is Senator Inhofe's issue as far as I'm concerned.
Do you think it's cynical or accurate to think that the gay marriage amendment comes up at times when an election is approaching, when conservatives are trying to rally their base?
All I can really say about that is I would certainly hope that people who are in a position of power, people who are leaders of the Senate, people who are senators, that I would hope no public official would ever try to, would ever start debating and discussing something as important as amending the Constitution strictly for political gain.
One of the things President Bush said, and this was in his State of the Union address in January 2004, is that for the good of families, children, and society, I support a constitutional amendment to protect the institution of marriage. Did you ever at all feel the inclination to speak up there and say, is it good for your family to ban gay marriage? I mean, for your family, it would be good to have that.
For me, it is, but you also have to understand that, from my perspective, Heather and I are married. We've been together now for almost 14 years. We've owned several houses together. We are currently renovating another house together. We have, built a life together, and quite frankly, I hope to spend the rest of my life with her. From my perspective, I'm just waiting for state and federal law to catch up with where we are. I'm not really sure that I'm something that families need to be protected from.
One of the things you write about in the book is about how you hated the way that John Kerry responded to Bob Schieffer's question at one of the debates about whether homosexuality was a choice. And what Kerry said was, "We're all God's children, Bob, and I think if you were to talk to Dick Cheney's daughter, who is a lesbian, she would tell you that she's being who she was born as." Now, you write in the book that you really hated his answer. You felt targeted by his remark. Your mother said, "This is not a good man. What a cheap and tawdry political trick." What so upset you about his response?
A couple of things. I think what made it so jarring was that he got a question he wasn't expecting. You know, in debate prep, and I said it in all my dad's debate prep sessions, we did lots of questions about gay marriage. We would do a question about gay civil rights. But we never asked, is homosexuality a choice? That was never one of the questions we talked about in debate prep. And my hunch would be it was one that the Kerry campaign didn't anticipate either. Because I think what happened is, you know, John Kerry had either programmed himself or been programmed by his handlers the goal on any question he got on gay issues was vice president and lesbian. Get those words in your answer. It was just so, ham-handed is probably the best way to put it. And quite honestly, I really don't think John Kerry ought to be speaking on my behalf. There are an awful lot of gay people on his side of the aisle that he could speak on behalf of.
Mary Cheney, her new memoir is called Now It's My Turn. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at pewtrusts.org. From Delacorte Press, publisher of A World Undone, The Story of the Great War, 1914 to 1918, by G.J. Meyer. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Mary Carr reads from her new collection of poems, Sinner's Welcome, and talks about her conversion to Catholicism after having been an agnostic. Also, we continue our interview with Mary Cheney about working on her father's vice presidential campaigns. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mary Cheney. She's written a memoir called Now It's My Turn about working on her father's vice presidential campaigns in 2000 and 2004. When we left off, we were discussing why she was offended by one of John Kerry's responses during a 2004 presidential debate. You were also very unhappy with something that John Edwards said in a debate with your father in 2004. This was in response to a question Gwen Ifill asked about same-sex marriage. And after your father said that freedom means freedom for everyone, an individual state should decide, how to regulate gay marriage. There shouldn't be a federal amendment. Edwards said, "I think that the vice president and his wife love their daughter. I think they love her very much. And you can't have anything but respect for the fact that they're willing to talk about the fact that they have a gay daughter, the fact that they embrace her. Now, that comment made you very angry. Tell us what you objected to about it.
Well, I do give John Edwards credit for being a heck of a lot smoother than his running mate was. But he is a recovering trial lawyer, so I suppose that's understandable. Honestly, the exact same thing that was upsetting when John Kerry did it was that it was a pretty obvious political attempt to focus attention on the fact that the vice president has a lesbian daughter. And basically to try and score a few cheap political points. That was actually what made me so upset.
You wrote that when your father told you that he was considering running for vice president, he said that he was concerned that people would target you and your sexual orientation in an attempt to attack him. In reading that, I wasn't sure whether he was concerned that people on the right would use your sexual orientation in an attempt to attack him, or people on the left, or both?
I don't remember ever having a conversation with him about, the attacks are going to come from the left or the right. I think he was just worried about, primarily, that he wanted to make sure that I understood that there would be a lot of media attention paid to it, which obviously there was. That people, honestly, John Kerry and John Edwards in 2004 are really good examples of people who would try and use the fact that my dad had a gay daughter to score some political points.
Well, I think what a lot of people would say was what Kerry and Edwards were trying to do there was to say, is this a little hypocritical to have a gay daughter, to support a gay daughter, and yet be part of a ticket that many people saw as demonizing homosexuality?
I certainly wouldn't say that our ticket demonized homosexuality. My dad has always made it very clear. My dad doesn't even support the federal marriage amendment, for starters. And the president, even though I disagree with him, and even though I think he's wrong on these issues, has always, in every statement I've ever seen, been very clear about saying that, look, this is what I think we need to do on this issue. However, we need to remember that it is important to treat everyone with respect and dignity.
Just to be clear, there was a very, very strong, values were emphasized so much, and values at the top of that list of values for the religious right, which was crucial to the Bush-Cheney ticket, at the top of their list was, the amendment to ban gay marriage.
Oh, see, I'm going to disagree with you there, Terry. When you talk about values, I think the values that were emphasized during the 2004 election were values of things like leadership and honesty. Those were the values that were really central to the 2004 campaign.
You worked for several years, I think, for Coors Brewery as their mm-hmm. marketing liaison to the gay community. I think they were trying to, repair their image after a boycott or a threatened boycott against them. Exactly what was the problem that you were hired to repair?
Well, I actually had several jobs at Coors, dealing primarily around public relations issues, handling issues like alcohol abuse, underage drinking, environmental issues, clean water, that kind of stuff. And Coors came to me and asked me to... I was actually getting ready to leave for business school. They came to me and asked me to stay on and do gay marketing, which, quite frankly, sounded like fun because it was a new field. It was something that maybe three Fortune 500 companies were actually doing at that point in time. And so I took it on as a challenge for a couple of years, I think 2 years maybe.
I'd be interested in hearing your response to this. Some people saw it as hypocritical that you took such a front when Kerry and Edwards mentioned in the debates that you were gay, but at the same time you had a job earlier, that was about marketing to the gay community. Do you see that as contradictory, or does that seem perfectly consistent to you?
I don't understand how it would be contradictory. I had a job at Coors, one of which was to help the company sell and market their product to gay and lesbian consumers. I had a job on the Bush Cheney campaign, which was to run vice presidential operations. And I don't recall ever having a job to be a poster child for John Kerry or John Edwards.
And you felt that that's how you were being used as a poster child? In what sense?
I was being used as a way for them to try and score some political points.
You said earlier that one of the reasons why you did not want to leave the campaign in 2004 after the president came out after the president came out in favor of a federal amendment, a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage, was because you really believed that the Bush-Cheney ticket was the best ticket for the safety of America. Have you retained your confidence in the war in Iraq? Do you think that the war was the right thing to do and that America is safer as a result of it?
I have no doubt about that. I think, unfortunately, I think the media give a very unfair view of what's been going on in Iraq. I mean, just think about this for a minute. The Iraqis have had 3 national elections in the last 3 years. In every single election, more people have come out and voted and participated than in previous elections. Prime Minister Maliki, if I got the pronunciation right, just named his cabinet, his full cabinet, including his the Secretary of the Interior and the Secretary of the Military. Those are huge accomplishments. And on top of everything else, Zarqawi was killed last week. And while he is not the be-all, end-all of the insurgency in Iraq, it is a severe blow to the insurgents in Iraq. And I think we are doing exactly the right thing there.
Mary Cheney, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, sure. Well, thank you for having me on.
Mary Cheney's new memoir is called Now It's My Turn. Coming up, Mary Carr reads from her new book of poems, Sinner's Welcome, and talks about her conversion from agnostic to Catholic. This is Fresh Air. In her best-selling memoirs, The Liar's Club and Cherry, Mary Carr wrote about growing up in a small Texas oil town. In the first book, she wrote about having been sexually abused as a child. In the second, she gave her version of teenage experiences, like conflicts with parents and teachers, crushes on boys, and figuring out who she really was. Now Carr has a new collection of poems called Sinner's Welcome. Carr is a professor of English literature at Syracuse University. Mary Carr, welcome back to Fresh Air. I'd like you to start with a poem called Delinquent Missive, but before you read it, would you tell us the story behind the poem?
One of my first of many unpaid jobs was tutoring this kid who had been in the 9th grade for a long time, and I was tutoring him in geometry, and he was sort of the guy, you know, who didn't really get a Halloween costume and just had a towel to tie around his neck. He was that guy, and he later, you know, had some serious mental problems and stabbed his father and went to jail.
And what did you decide to write a poem about him?
Well, he's somebody who's always haunted me. I mean, he's someone to whom I wasn't kind because I was afraid of him when I was a kid. I mean, he must have been, he looked like he was 20 years old. You know, he was rusty-handed and slouching and kind of, you know, with this forehead that stuck out over his face and so I was frightened of him. And in retrospect, as I looked back over my life, I had enormous pity for him.
Would you read the poem?
Sure. Delinquent Missive. Before David Ricardo stabbed his daddy 16 times with a fork, once for every year of my screwed-up life, he'd long showed signs of being bent. In school, he got no Valentine nor birthday cake embellished with his name. On Halloween, a towel tied around his neck was all he had to be a hero with. He spat in the punch bowl and smelled like a foot. His forehead was a ledge he leered beneath. When I was sent to tutor him in geometry, so he might leave, at last, ninth grade, he sat running pencil lead beneath his nails. If radiance shone from those mud-hole eyes, I missed it. Thanks, David, for your fine slang. You called my postulates post-holes. Your mom endured ferocious of the liver. Plus you ignored, when I saw you wave at lunch, my flinch. Maybe by now your ectoplasm, or the zillionth winner of the Texas death penalty sweepstakes, or you occupy a locked room with a small, round window held fast by rivets through which you are watched. But I hope some organism drew your care, orchid or cockroach even, some inmate in a wheelchair whose steak you had to cut since he lacked hands. In this way, the unbudgeable stone that plugged the tomb hole in your chest could roll back, and in your sad, slit eyes could blaze that star adored by its maker.
That's from Mary Carr's new book of poems, Sinner's Welcome. Mary, there's actually a lot of violence in this book. You know, there's the person who you just wrote about in that poem who stabbed his father. There's a poem about your mother coming at you with a knife. There's somebody who tries to commit suicide by shooting himself.
There's a serial killer. There's even a
serial killer. The serial killer, too, yeah.
It's not the first serial killer poem, but...
I guess, you know, not everybody has had a life exposed to that much violence.
Well, if you'd grown up in my hometown, you would have been exposed to it, too. It's interesting. I actually went on the internet once and looked at the statistics for murder and suicide in my hometown, and they're way up there. They're close to what they are in, like, Bosnia. And for reasons I don't fully understand, it's certainly not the poorest place in the country by any stretch. But it is a place where there are a lot of oil refineries and so forth. And I've always speculated that someday they're going to discover some bizarre PCB or something that just turns people into Hannibal Lecter.
This is a small town in Texas where you grew up.
It is a small town in East Texas that I tend not to name.
Now, at the same time that there are several poems about violence in your book, the book is also about grace, or about the hope of finding grace. And it's about your life before and after finding some sense of God. In one poem, a poem called At the Sound of the Gunshot Leave a Message, about a friend's suicide attempt, you write, "Godless, our minds did monster us." Again, a sense of, you know, what you were like before.
Well, it's funny. That poem is for the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Franz Wright. And it was a message he had long ago when we were young poets living in Cambridge on his machine. You'd call his house and he'd say, "At the sound of the gunshot, leave a message." Darkly funny.
Yeah. Let me just ask you about that line, "Godless, our minds did monster us." You're using monster as a verb. I think that's so great.
Well, I'm stealing from the good guys. I mean, there are lots of poets who use words the way they're not meant to be used and hopefully break them open in some new way. But I do feel like my mind could, for a long time, just sort of warp everything in the dark direction. I think that's my natural state of mind. I'm serotonin challenged, as I like to say.
You write that you converted to Catholicism in 1996, quote, "after a lifetime of undiluted agnosticism." You know, in our previous interview, you talked about Gaudorama, how you and your son went to all kinds of places of worship searching for God. How did Catholicism win?
I love the carnality of the Catholic Church. If you had told me I was going to be a Catholic, by the way, I would have laughed you out of the room. A friend of mine, Tobias Wolff, who's also my son's godfather, a fiction writer who wrote a great book called This Boy's Life and Pharaoh's Army, you know, really a wonderful fiction writer as well, attended a little Catholic church in Syracuse where we both taught, and I first went to Mass with Toby. And I loved that there was a body on the cross. You know, in the Episcopal Church or Protestant churches, when you walk in, it's pretty subtle, you know. I mean, there's no body. It's very abstract. And in some ways, the meatiness, the fact that you stand up and kneel down, it's not exactly aerobics class, but, you know, your body bends in the way these other people's bodies bend. And in Catholicism, there's a great tradition of working with the poor and not just writing a check, but actually showing up and setting up soup kitchens. But I guess, I don't know, somehow I was very captured early by one of the churches I went to, Jerry Berrigan went to, and, you know, Ted Berrigan, his brother, they had been Vietnam activists, and they were still very active against nuclear power. And that impressed me, that they were still going to prison in their 70s, fighting these things, as well as, you know, helping people out of El Salvador and taking care of mothers with no place to live. And somebody was, the priest was always standing up and saying, you know, does anybody have a crib? Does anybody have an extra bed? So that sense of involvement with the poor was very impressive to me.
How much of a role did drinking play in trying to give up drinking? How much of a role did that play in leading you toward prayer?
This sounds so crazy, because if you had told me this before I started praying, I would have just told you you were nuts. But I couldn't stop drinking. I kept drinking, and I would sort of, every now and then I would try to get help for it, and I would just wind up drinking again and driving into stuff. And at the end, I was driving into really big things, and it just really seemed ill-advised.
Do you mean like literally with your car?
Yeah, yeah. You'd be driving with your car, yeah, and all of a sudden there would be this big piece of concrete in front of you that you hadn't seen before. I mean, I think of just the moral irresponsibility of that horrifies me. But somebody had suggested that I pray, and I said, but I don't believe in God, and she just kind of laughed and said, well, look, why don't you try it for 30 days? Pray on your knees in the morning and ask for help, and at night, say thanks. And I said, well, what do I have to say thanks for? And she just kind of mocked me and said, well, you know, you'll think of something. And my first thank yous were more pitiful. I always had plenty to beg for. You know, I could always go in with a tin cup in the morning for things I wanted, a parking place in Cambridge. I mean, learning to be grateful for things was something that was just not a habit I had. I just think, you know, my mother gave me Sartre to read when I was in the sixth grade, and I just think I had this dark sort of existentialist cant on things. I thought about death all the time, even when I was a little kid. And oddly enough, as I began to pray, I began to see all the things there were going on. Like she said, just go through the day. Another friend of mine said, go through the day, and if something good happens to you, just say, you know, thanks. I said, well, who do I say thanks to? He said, you know, this just isn't that hard. Just say thanks. And I began to see, you know, you take a sip of coffee and bite a Dunkin' Donut with just a really winning combination. And I think, this is really good. Maybe this is why everybody else isn't screaming. So just the little things I began to appreciate, not least, of course, the presence of my son.
In your book, you write that in my godless household, when you were growing up, poems were the closest we came to sacred speech, the only prayers I remember. So what was the place of poems in your house when you were a child?
Oh, we said them all the time. I mean, from the time I was little, I memorized Shakespeare. Usually my big sister, starting when I was very little, I imagine too little to actually even read the poems. My sister must have helped me memorize them, but we both remember, my mother remembered, that I used to say them. The major speeches, not the sonnets so much, but the speeches from the plays, I said. And we just read aloud to each other all the time. I write about reading J. Alfred Prufrock aloud to my sister when she's getting dressed to go on a date. She must have been about 15 and I was 13, or she was 14, I was 12, and she's teasing her hair and spraying it with Aquanet, and I'm saying, listen to this, you know, let us go then, you and I, while the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. I mean, I can still say a lot of the poem. And she's like, oh my God, you know, read that again, but, you know, don't tell anybody you're reading this stuff. It was like pornography or something. I knew it was something that the average human unit in Southeast Texas wasn't aspiring to.
My guest is Mary Carr. Her new collection of poems is called Sinner's Welcome. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mary Carr, and she has a new book of her poems. It's called Sinner's Welcome. You started making the rounds of various places of faith when your son was young, and I'm wondering if he became a Catholic too.
Yes, we were both ordained, and he asked to be confirmed. When he was 16, he was confirmed as well. So we were baptized on the same day in 96, and then he was confirmed when he was 16.
So has that become like another bond between the two of you?
Absolutely. I remember getting in the car on the way back. We were baptized on Holy Saturday, the day before Easter Sunday, and then there was a big party at our little church, and we're riding home, and I said, well, how do you feel? Do you feel different? And he said, yeah, I feel like I'm part of this big family, which is a way I feel. I mean, I feel like we're a big dysfunctional family. It really comforts me to be in Italy or to be in another country, Mexico, anywhere, another city, even San Francisco, and go to Mass. I'm also very big on a lot of rites of the church that some people feel awful about, like confession. I'm crazy about going to confession. And
why?
I don't know. I guess in the past, pre-Vatican II or something, people had these awful experiences, either of just not really being able to say what they'd done that they felt bad about, or of being chastised by the priest. And, you know, I'm often told, you know, Jesus loves you, God loves you, you know, go in peace. And I'm not given so much penances as, you know, things that I should do, like, you know, well, why don't you, you know, for the next month, you know, read from the scriptures every morning before you pray, or, you know, why don't you do some volunteer work, for the AIDS hospice or for the soup kitchen. It's much more, I'm often given a much more active thing rather than don't do this or go punish yourself. I don't know. I'm often, I think, led to or encouraged. I feel sort of loved into acting better as much as anything by the priest I've come into contact with.
I want you to read one final poem from your new book, Sinner's Welcome. And this is called Entering the Kingdom. It's, you know, you have poems in here about being a daughter and poems about being a mother. This is a poem about being a mother. If there's a story behind the poem, I hope you'll tell it to us before you read it.
Well, certainly if anything introduces you to love and patience and tolerance, it's having a child. You also learn about murderous rage, you know. But this is a poem about my son sort of crossing that boundary when he becomes his own person, and I begin to see him as himself rather than as some offshoot of me. Entering the kingdom. As the boy's bones lengthened and his head and heart enlarged, his mother one day failed to see herself in him. He was a man then, radiating the innate loneliness of men. His expression was ever after, beyond her. When, near sleep, his features eased toward childhood, it was brief. She could only squeeze his broad shoulder. What could she teach him of loss, who now inflicted it by entering the kingdom of his own will?
I must say I love that last line about entering the kingdom of his own will. And I'm wondering if you could talk about how that came to you.
Well, it often seems that when I'm trying to defend myself, when I'm trying most to be big, when I'm trying to stand up for myself, when I'm trying to right the egregious wrongs that the world have done to me, are really when I often make myself smallest. In some ways, I guess, my own will is a kingdom, or one's own will is a kingdom. I mean, you sort of reign supreme, you mow down people to get the parking place, and you scrabble to get the last banana in the bowl. And there's a way when I just accept what the world is bringing me rather than fighting for what I think I want. It's not really much of a kingdom, is it? So I look at my son scrambling for the right girl, the right job, the right school, as we all scramble for something. And, you know, it's not always a great crown to wear getting what you want. Or at least that's been my experience as a Christian, that I do best when I can get really quiet and listen and try to take some guidance from that. I always say it's like south of my neck, there's like a bubble in the middle of me. And if I get quiet enough so the bubble's between the two lines, there's something other than me that's that's steering the ship, and that's always where things just work out better. I don't know why.
And finally, tell us why you called your new collection of poems Sinner's Welcome.
The church I go to in Syracuse has a banner out in front of it. That's like the banner you see in a car park, and it says, Sinner's Welcome. And I loved it when I saw it. I mean, because I always thought people who went to church went because they were good. And I like the idea that you could not be a particularly good person and still be really welcome in church, that there were whores and thieves and tax collectors and all kinds of venal people who followed Jesus and with some joy and a sense that they were welcome and were going to be given mercy.
Mary Carr, thank you very much for talking with us and for reading some of your poems. Thank you.
Terry, thanks for having me on.
Mary Carr's new collection of poems is called Sinner's Welcome. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Art of War by Sun Tzu, in stores and online at bn.com. From Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies, these reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves, angieslist.com. And from BMW, where the halls are filled with independent thinkers because the company is independent too. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with New York Times environmental reporter Andrew Refkin about going to the North Pole to report on an expedition measuring climate change in the Arctic. He's written a new book called The North Pole Was Here. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.